Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Friday, October 30th, 2009, I am delighted to be joined by Beth Cantor, author of Beth's blog, How Nonprofits Can Use Social Media. Welcome, Beth.
Great. Thanks for having me.
I know. Last second, we got you in. My computer decided to freeze, so I apologize. Couldn't welcome you more formally before now. So I wanted to start with kind of a, for you probably, a question that's like, no-brainer. But, you know, between the nonprofits I work with and the companies I work with, you know, there's still that question out there is, you know, of weighing the risks and the promise of social media. So in the nonprofit world, what kind of inspired you to feel like the promise of social media is what it's become or is becoming?
That's a really good question. You know, I think what excited me, well, let me back up a second. I admit it, I'm an early adopter, and I've had quite a lot of Kool-Aid. So take it with a grain of salt if we have any skeptics listening. But I've been working with nonprofits and technology since the late 80s, early 90s. And my entree into technology was through bulletin boards and in the early stages of right before the web was created, like in that early 90s period. And I was doing a network with artists online that was Unix-based and helping artists with who are visual people to use a text-based system. So I did a lot of art therapy as well.
Okay. Yeah.
But I gravitated towards setting up a blog in, 2001, 2002 with what became Blogger Software, and then eventually started Beth's blog in 2003, along with another blog called Cambodia for Kids.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I started that was because I adopted two kids from Cambodia, and I wanted to learn about Cambodian culture. And what really amazed me was the first comment that I got was from a young university student in Phnom Penh in Cambodia who answered my question about, is there a tooth fairy in Cambodia? What do you do with it when a kid loses their tooth in Cambodia?
And, you got to tell us the answer.
The answer is if it's a lower tooth, you throw it on the roof so the tooth will grow up, and if it's a upper tooth, you bury it under the bed or bury it in the ground, so the tooth will grow down.
Wow, interesting. Sorry to put you on that caveat, but I could not know.
Oh, of course. And it was really funny, too, because I had made a little video of him wiggling his tooth, and another blogger named Juana, actually, we started talking on Skype, and he taught us the Cambodian word for tooth. But don't ask me to repeat it because I'll probably mispronounce it. And so the idea there was, this is pretty amazing. If I'm able to connect with strangers halfway around the world, around a common interest, this is pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. So that was your eureka moment.
Yes.
So, I mean, you know, you are an early adopter, and, you know, a big part of that is being pretty comfortable trying new things. So, you know, in terms of kind of the tools that we use now that have become mainstream, what do you consider, and I know you've been involved in projects that are about, you know, startup kits and talk about tools, what do you think are the most important tools for nonprofits today?
Okay, tools as in the actual tools themselves or tools as in mindsets?
Actually, both. I mean, in the broadest sense, because if you don't have the right mindset, and this, you know, this is chicken and egg, right? So if you don't have the mindset going into it, the tools aren't going to really make that much sense. And then same thing, if you start with a tool that you really like, but you're using it in, say, you know, maybe a slightly questionable way. I mean, one thing that made me think about this is that, you know, you come from such an earnest place, right? You're talking about the children that you've adopted, and there's something really lovely about that. But one of the things that strikes me is that you've always seemed to be able to balance the kind of etiquette that's developed over the years. And part of that is kind of using the right tools, matching the tools to the objective you're trying to reach, right?
Mm-hmm.
So somehow you've been able to do that, even though you've been a very early adopter of things that have developed etiquette kind of as it goes.
Well, actually, it's probably because I'm not a techie. I know people, I say that, jaws drop. I'm not technical. I'm more of a strategist, and I'm more of a trainer and a learner. So in terms of a mindset, nonprofits have to come to social media and these tools with a mindset around learning and a little bit of reflection. And I like to use the term learning organization. And not many organizations have that kind of culture, the kind of try it, fix it approach.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking at perfection right away or don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's, as we know, is not what happens when you begin to use social media, because there is kind of a learning process and kind of insights that you need to develop as you create and implement pilots. And that's a mind shift from, like, the way of working before is to, like, spend a year and a half planning something, a big,
yeah,
huge something, go out and get a big, huge grant, and then implement it. And that's a different way. There's a different approach with social media. And this is more about kind of incremental, developmental approach, as opposed to, you know, planning, implement it, measure it, you know, and repeat the cycle. The other thing that's needed, I always think about, I think it was Jeremiah Aliang who first said this, or I think I read it on his blog. I love the quote. It's, the tools come and go, strategy sustains.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to, like, really be careful about fondling the hammer or getting too in love with the tools without thinking about the strategy and why we're doing it and what outcomes we want to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always this inherent tension between tactics and tools and strategy. And so we can't, once we have a strategy, we can't just endlessly plan and have strategy. We actually have to go and do something.
Yeah, absolutely. So one example that I think about, Christine Austin is a client of mine, and she is fantastic. And one question that we've discussed at different points, but she passed on to me for you, was that, you know, this changing sense of who a reporter is, right, and how nonprofits can, you know, look at really online media monitoring tools beyond Google Analytics, which, you know, is kind of more site analytic based, but, you know, the listening tools, that conversation piece that maybe, you know, is a part, obviously, of both businesses and, you know, for-profit businesses and nonprofit businesses learning to adapt to the new, the way that we communicate online now. So what are, with that in mind, you know, what are some of the listening tools that you think are the best or recommend?
Well, again, I'm going to answer it with the kind of mindset strategy piece as well as the actual tool itself.
Mm-hmm.
So before you even get into the tools, the most important thing to know how to do is to figure out what are you going to do with all that information or knowledge that you get from listening? How are you going to apply it? What decisions? What is it that you're listening for, and how will you ultimately use it? Because you don't want it to wind up like, you know, a big research project that just sits on the shelf and gets stale.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next thing that's really important and not related to the tools is what keywords are you going to use? What keywords are going to get you the most bang for your buck? And you're going to know those pretty soon. And the other thing that you need to understand, again, is this kind of listening and learning loop that you have to, learning loop approach that you need to take when you begin listening. And I see many nonprofits getting frustrated is that they sort of jump in and they expect to get it right the first time, and that really doesn't happen. You have to kind of experiment with your keywords, see what comes back, understand what the patterns are, and then adjust your keywords. So there's just a little bit of looping that happens. In terms of listening tools, I usually recommend to nonprofits who are just starting out to start with the free tools. I'm talking about Google Alerts, Twitter is a fantastic listening tool. There's something called Social Mention, Technorati, and even just doing keyword searches on social networks and YouTube, and just, you know, getting a lay of the land out in social space for what people are saying about your issue or your organization and where your people are hanging out. And then I think if volume becomes an issue, you know, if people are really talking about you so much that it's too much for one brain to synthesize, then we can sort of upgrade to the more professional tools, the paid analytics tools that are combining the listening and the monitoring with actually summarizing and creating charts and graphs and word crowds and integrating some form of what we call sentiment analysis, which is the tone of what people are saying. Is it positive or negative? And I've been, the one I have experience with right now is Radiant 6. And
I was just going to say, all of the things you listed are available in Radiant 6, so I know you must have used it at least at one point.
Well, you graduate to something like Radiant 6 when, which is a fabulous tool, using the free tools, there's a fair amount of cutting and pasting that you need to do because it's not just like reading the streams. You have to kind of summarize it and maybe put it into a one-pager and email that out, or maybe dump some stuff into a spreadsheet, or so that other people can help execute a plan or even just to analyze it. And Radiant 6 like really cuts that workflow, cuts all that really boring cutting and pasting stuff that you don't want to do and that you probably hand to an intern and probably never gets done. it cuts it.
Unfortunately. So there's the online media monitoring piece. So we're talking about, you know, starting with alerts, just to kind of reiterate what you're saying, Google Alerts, maybe cross that with Yahoo Alerts. I love Social Mention, and they have an alert system, as you mentioned. You know, and then there's a few others out there where you can go and search. And, of course, Social Mention searches across comments, YouTube, and some other places as well, and does give you a kind of rough sentiment rating as well right within the free tool. And you can then graduate, as you said, to the pay tools. But part of the, I think, challenge when you look at some of the larger organizations where they have to be, the typical, you know, nonprofit scenario where they're trying, their effort is around protecting or not disclosing, and maybe either because they're bound by law. So maybe healthcare examples are probably the ones that I'm thinking most of, right? Where, you know, children's faces can't be shown, and there are challenges around that. And then you have the issue of you know, making sure that your staff are up to speed. And so, you know, there are organizations that have media policies about who you can and can't talk to. And now, you know, I mean, Tom Foremski, when I interviewed him, said, you know, everybody is a media outlet, every single person, every single organization. Have you had experience where you can give specific counsel, you know, or you know, refer to an example where, you know, a company, you know, a nonprofit has had to reassess its media policy and how to counsel employees about how things have changed in terms of, you know, an actual reporter call versus a blogger call, or even former employees that talk to each other that maybe have started a blog talk radio show or something else where there could be infringements of something like a HIPAA policy.
Oh, you know, the best example of that, well, let me back up. What you're referring to is this social media policy, and that begins with having a discussion, usually about the things that are of concern, all those things that you talked about. And so you have the overall policy, and that's kind of like your tone and philosophy, and I believe that organizations should be encouraging and realize the world has changed and that everybody can be a spokesman. And I know that that's a hard thing to grasp if you're not immersed in this, in social media. So that takes a lot of kind of organizational change management approaches and kind of discussion and really kind of looking, examining what the concerns and the fears are and coming up with, you know, concrete examples and steps on, you know, how to protect the organization or how to protect the employee. You know, I'm thinking of, for example, in philanthropy, family foundations cannot lobby politicians or they could lose their 501c3 status. So
right.
There's a big concern about using social media and could that, you know, could something be construed as lobbying? And so, and I've been in conversations like this, and so it doesn't, so we actually got very concrete. We said, like, you know, let's say a staff person is on Twitter and they're self-identified with the organization, with the foundation, and they retweet, you know, sign this healthcare petition. Tell Congress to, you know, pass the Healthcare Reform Act. You know, is that lobbying? And then it's sitting with, you know, the legal department and really exploring this.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of immediately knee-jerking saying, no, we can't do it. You can't be on Twitter. I mean, you can't keep people from doing it. There's probably, you know, people are using social networks. You know, that's just the reality that it is. So it behooves the organizations to develop a policy.
Mm-hmm.
Not just cut and paste boilerplate, but really discuss it,
create it.
Educate employees about why it's important, and then enforce it when it needs to be enforced. And I'm not saying that in a kind of police state way. But,
yeah, I know what you mean.
They say effective policies require those two E's, education and enforcement.
And hopefully, you know, one of the things that I think is so important about media policies, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, is I think that hopefully by starting that discussion, you start thinking of other examples or ways that you need to either consider protection or consider, you know, consider a piece that might be missing in training or something else where employees can have a real part of what helps the organization, you know, do the protection that it needs to through the policy.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's sort of, you know, policy, you know, one of the things that we discovered, you know, there was this kind of employees are going to waste their entire day using Facebook. You know, I used to hear this when, you know, 15 years ago when we were first creating acceptable internet use policies, you know, employees are going to waste their time all day shopping or looking at porn. And so we have acceptable use. I know. Well, do you trust your employees? But, you know, so we have acceptable internet use policies. That's sort of a standard part of IT. So that would, social media would, or using Facebook would be covered. You know, it's a part of your job.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not part of your job, then, you know, some policies say you shouldn't be using your work email to, you know, set up your Facebook account, and you shouldn't be using it during work time. Or some policies say we allow you to use, you know, we realize that employees have a personal life and you may need to do some personal work during your work hours, and that's okay, but don't abuse it.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, what would you counsel, what is your general counsel to nonprofits, especially considering that so many of these tools, for example, Facebook, you can effectively do with the phones that, you know, the mobile phones that most people have today. So, you know, I can sit here and check Facebook while we're, you know, doing this show and, you know, maybe never use my computer that I use for work. So, you know, I mean, you know, with the idea that the policy is to, you know, protect or hopefully, you know, let's say the trust is there with employees, but the concern is more about, you know, doing research on Facebook about a client and maybe that's not okay. Maybe that is okay, maybe it's not okay, but it's probably, in, you know, it could be construed as an infringement somehow of their rights. you know, what do you, how do you factor in new technologies like, you know, mobile's not hardly new, but some of the applications are certainly new that allow us to communicate on multiple levels at the same time?
Well, what I think you I hear you say is you brought up an important point about how, and in fact, it was just a whole conference just on this, social networking sites, friend or foes, and I think the keynote was somebody from the FBI.
Mm-hmm.
And Aspen Baker wrote a guest post about it, and I just published it a day or two ago, and it goes into a lot more depth on this. But, you know, how, you know, what can you do with information that you've collected online about people? You know, what's legal,
mm-hmm.
what's not legal, what's a violation of, you know, privacy? So, again, I think it comes down to, in terms of the policy, in terms of within inside of the organization's walls, is to have that discussion and to understand in a fair amount of detail what, you know, what are the implications of this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's going to happen in practice? To do a lot of what-if scenarios. What if we did X? Could that get us into trouble? And being and involving the right people in those discussions.
Mm-hmm.
Just a part of, like, a due diligence internally of, you know, like you, a due diligence internally, like how do we make the best use of our resources and how do we protect the organization? Like, what if you hold an event, do you get liability insurance?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're, you know, I don't want to scare people, but if, you know, serving on a board, are you going to get liability insurance if the organization gets sued so your board members' personal assets aren't at stake?
So I think, you know, part of I think the policy discussion, I don't want to spend too much time on the policy piece because I'm sure some people are going, oh, this is, you know, this is the most exciting topic, but it is important. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I wonder about is, you know, case law is not exactly the best guiding force in terms of, you know, what you can and can't do. I think the discussion that you went to in the guest blog post, which we'll definitely link to from my site as well, talking about, you know, privacy, you know, rights and more of the civil rights stuff that's already on the books that could be construed as, you know, a violation here or there is very important to look at. But, you know, have you come across this sort of frustration about, you know, case law kind of catching up to social media? Because it's certainly, you know, there's a lot of things that are really undefined territory.
Absolutely. I think in that very post, she mentions how the lawyer at Facebook, the counselor, the person who's in charge of legal at Facebook, encourages people to, you know, to make it into a legal case because it's uncharted territory and needs to have it defined.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's been the case with the Internet in general.
Yeah, I think, yeah, I definitely agree. And I think that, you know, it's one of those areas where, you know, again, I think that lawyers look at, you know, have to look more broadly at, you know, civil rights law, other sets of laws that could potentially be extended as well into the social media sphere. Who do you think is doing a good job of sort of tracking social media and legal implications from an informational point of view? Someone that, you know, because I feel like that's, you know, maybe something that's missing or that I don't know about.
I think if you go to the Berkman Center at Harvard,
mm-hmm.
which is part of the Harvard Law School, and it's
mm-hmm.
the Internet and the Law, that you'd go there and go to those blogs and go to the fellows who are writing about that. And you will find, within that, you will branch out and find key experts.
Definitely.
In fact, there's a Jonathan Zittrain.
So, yes, there's a whole, the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, and there's some featured events and different things. So we'll link to this as well because it looks like there's also Radio Berkman as well so people can listen to a podcast. I think that's so incredibly important. And I know great work is being done at Stanford as well, but what, you know, and we'll have Ryan Kahlo on, who's an academic fellow at Stanford, as part of their internet culture piece. But I haven't seen, you know, obviously Harvard, with having such a large publishing arm, has a lot of ability to, you know, get information out there quickly and through some platforms that they already have.
They used to host a conference called iLaw,
mm-hmm.
which I'm sure is the proceedings and resources are linked from the site. And then, of course, the Electronic Frontier Foundation would also be a great resource, particularly for privacy.
Mm-hmm. And I think we've all probably, hopefully most people have heard of them. They've done great work for a long time.
And there are a couple of bloggers on BlogHer who cover the law beat, including Lisa Stone, one of the founders, who would also be good people to read.
So Lisa Stone and anybody else you would recommend?
Well, go to the BlogHer site and look under law, legal.
Okay. Because it never hurts to have those resources, especially when you're not sure if you should start that, you know, the conversation that can be a long one with internal counsel, and people do get afraid, and, you know, there's definitely, you know, there are definitely issues internally. One thing I wanted to turn to is, you know, the donation climate. Obviously, with the down economy, it's, you know, seems more challenging than it's been in a while to, you know, solicit donations, especially in the very giving Bay Area. But what do you recommend in terms of using social media to, for lack of a better phrase, convert mentions to donations?
Oh, that's all.
I know, it's a big one.
I know. Well, I think what's important is this whole notion of building your network before you need it.
Mm-hmm.
Know that you're not treating your donors like an ATM machine. And all of us have been guilty around that. And so you need to be really careful that we build relationships, we say thank you, we make it easy for them to contribute and feel a part of it. I also am a big believer in this whole notion of multi-channel
mm-hmm.
strategies, which means that social media is one piece of a fundraising strategy, you know, your
mm-hmm.
social strategy piece. And whether that is, you know, whether you're doing it on Facebook, on Twitter, or using those tools to accelerate your fundraising solicitations in other mediums so that you're not only just using social media, but it's cross-promoting and cross-channeling and supporting what you're doing with your email, what's happening on your website, what's happening offline.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, what do you consider, you know, the way, what are the sort of, getting into the more tactical pieces, what are some of the tactical things that an organization can do? So let's say they have, you know, hopefully they have an email sign-up list. What's the best way to sort of start the dialogue, you know, and they've used it maybe more for volunteering and they haven't really broadened it out to some of the social media channels, or they've avoided donations, but the climate has made it as such that they really need to use it for anything they can. So donations then become part of the equation. How do you recommend kind of engaging in that dialogue? Is it more frequent contact? Is it more, what is it?
Well, if we're broadening up and talking about social media, I mean, I'm sorry.
If we're
talking about social media or everything, but I'm going to
actually. So let's say that the goals of an organization are around obviously spreading the word that the organization exists, and hopefully if they're on an email list, you realize they're there, so you have their email address. But then once you have them kind of in your loop, you've got a couple, let's say you have at least two objectives. One would be hopefully if they can provide a donation, to think about providing a donation. And then the other is if they can't donate money, perhaps donate time. So, you know, if traditionally you've sent out a newsletter about all the great things you're doing, how do you then, you know, and again, this is really more of a tactic of conversation. How do you kind of turn, without making it feel really abrupt, from a conversation about here's our monthly newsletter to, you know, here's what, you know, is it more like here's what we're doing on social channels and reporting on what we're doing, and here's how you can get involved. How does that transition, you think, take place, or who's done a good job of it?
So you're talking about specifically email fundraising approaches?
Well, email, there can be others, but because I'm thinking email's pretty, you know, it's one that a lot of organizations have used, you know, they've got, so even if they haven't really embarked on social media in a big way, they may have been using email marketing for newsletter purposes, or they've built that database of people that have opted in to hear information about the organization, and the organization decides they're going to broaden the message. You know, how does that, you know, because I think that's one of the pieces that's kind of the, you know, more in the minutiae of how we communicate with those that are in the loop of an organization without feeling like, it, you know, again, that ATM machine feeling of, okay, you signed up for a list, now give us money. They may have signed up years ago and it was more about a newsletter, you know, and now we need to sort of change the messaging to, you know, including things like follow us on Twitter, follow us, you know, become our fan on Facebook, join our cause on Facebook or causes.org, petitions that they can potentially sign. Have you seen anybody do that without really jarring that core group that they had to begin with?
Well, in terms of email, you have to have there's kind of an art to the copy. And it's also a lot of testing and learning, so I'm assuming that they're not just blasting out their newsletter with the same old template they've been using for the last 5 or 6 years, and that they are experimenting with different calls to action, different formats, different lengths, different ways of bolding, you know, where they're going to pull people back to, and then checking that against their metrics and having a sense of what works with their audience.
Right.
So there's all that happens. And then there's, of course, the kind of what makes a really good email a fundraising pitch, you know, that they know the art of the subject line and that they know how to, you know, tell a story, you know, give the context and have a really clear call to action, and that they're following up with a thank you, that there's also maybe some offline donor cultivation as well, if that's possible, particularly if it's a local organization. I think some of the organizations that are really good at email fundraising are some of the large advocacy organizations that have been doing it for a while. I think about the Humane Society is fabulous. And National Wildlife Federation, American Cancer Society, Planned Parenthood, that have, you know, a history and a department and the capacity and knowledge of doing like email over the last 10 years. There's a woman who's actually here in San Francisco. Her name is Madeline Stanonis, and she wrote like kind of the classic Bible on nonprofit email fundraising. It's a small little book, and it's like everything you ever need to know about email fundraising, which has like all the secrets of the trade. So I'd highly recommend that book because Madeline is the expert in that area.
That's great. So in terms of, you know, the other piece is that, you know, obviously you're involved, and you know, another facet of you is that you know, as you mentioned earlier, you're kind of a worldwide leader when it really comes to nonprofits. I mean, you've won just about every award there is out there, and I think they've probably created some new ones for you, and more power to you because you've earned every one of them. Is there one that sticks out for you as, you know, and this is sort of, you know, changing course a bit, but one that sticks out for you is one that you're particularly proud of?
Well, I'm really, really grateful for the attention, and I appreciate the awards, but sometimes I get embarrassed.
Yeah, I don't mean to embarrass you either or put you on the spot.
But, you know, when I got I was surprised by the Fast Company one, which are one of the most influential women in technology. Mm-hmm. And what I did was, when I got that, I was really excited, but I was also, oh, well, these lists and these awards, there's people that are left out, and there's so many wonderful women in the nonprofit tech field. I just put together my own list, which was women in nonprofit technology who rock, and I just did a whole list of like 30 women. and sort of said, these guys deserve it too.
Yep. But is there one, you know, so I know that you have this new role as a fellow at the Packard Foundation. Can you tell us more about what you're doing there and what you hope to achieve?
The Packard Foundation for many years has had this opportunity called Visiting Scholar, and it's by invitation only, and they find someone who, you know, high-level achievement in the field and matches an area of their interest, something that they're researching and looking at or related to their programs. And the Packard Foundation, as you may know, has this program called Organizational Effectiveness, you know, how organizations can do their work more effectively. And those are sort of smaller grants that they make to existing grantees. And it's typically working with a consultant and maybe developing a strategic plan or helping them design a new accounting system or whatever. So about 2 years ago, they started to explore this whole notion of organizations working as networks. And what they realized is a lot of their grantees aren't really organizations, but networks. And then made them wonder about, well, what about network effectiveness? So they have spent the last 2.5 years in this exploration with Monitor Institute looking at network effectiveness.
Beth, you sound a little bit far away.
Sure, looking at network effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go, you can see a body of that work on a site called workingwickly.net. You can find a white paper, Networked for Social Change, I think, is the tagline.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so social media is kind of a part of this, at least with external communications and to some degree internal coordination as well. So I got the invitation, and I thought immediately, I said, scholar, does that mean I sit in a room all by myself, don't talk to anybody, and just study stuff and know everything? And I said, that's not me. I want to be Scholar 2.0 because my brain, is, I have a global brain. You know, it's externalized, and I learn through connections.
Uh-huh.
So it's been this wonderful – so part of my work has been internally with staff and also with grantees, kind of training, learning, and doing around how to use social media effectively as a nonprofit or within a network. And then the other half, as a scholar, you are also can do work on your own work, and so that's been blogging. And I'm co-writing a book called The Network to Nonprofit with Allison Fine.
Mm-hmm.
So so if you'll notice, a number of my blog posts now are, you know, I've really gone deep into this exploration of network effectiveness and sort of thinking about how it applies to social media nonprofits.
Mm-hmm. So is that, you know, so I'd love to hear more about what you hoped. So when you first, you know, got the word and, you know, the things that you've been able to do, what do you hope the end result will be, and how much time do you have to be able to do that?
It's a short-term scholarship. And, you know, I have a particular work plan, and one of them was writing the book, and it's the draft's been submitted. We're in editing now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been accomplished. Another, in terms of my own work, was at least writing 3 blog posts a week about the topic, and that's been more than accomplished. And also, I don't know how many, I have to go actually tally them up, but I have had many, 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 many coaching sessions with grantees. I have facilitated or been part of social media trainings. In fact, I'm doing one next week for their locals program. And also I've been a part of many meetings within the foundation, working with program staff, as well as participating when they brought in experts and other topics, which I've also blogged about.
Yeah, and is there anything that has struck you or surprised you in working with other grantees or other scholars?
Yes. Oh, that it is, like, incredible to talk about ideas.
You know,
I'm noticing different audiences, and a lot of times when I'm working with nonprofits, you know, you have ideas, but you also give me the tips. Give me how do you do this?
Mm-hmm.
So So for me, it's been a really enriching experience to be able to do the big picture idea, systematic change kind of thinking, but also look at that and see how it informs being in the weeds. And also, being in the weeds, how does that inform your kind of 10,000-mile view, 10,000-mile high view?
Right.
So it's kind of like this equal amounts of theory and practice. So to me, that is like what I love, theory and practice. And
so
how they inform each other.
Yeah, and I think that it's wonderful when you can have that sort of perspective to lend to others as well, who are kind of knee-deep in the trenches and maybe not thinking as broadly as they'd like to.
Yeah, or when you get too into, I got to get things done on my to-do list, and you don't have
right.
that time to actually think. I find myself, when I'm in those situations, I'm not a happy person. But I do like to get work done.
I can understand. I mean, you know, one thing that I think that strikes me as interesting is how, you know, it's almost like, and tell me if I'm wrong, but it's almost like you, by being an early adopter and caring about nonprofits, you really filled the need. And by filling that need, it became a career.
Yeah, well, it's been the last 15 years. And prior to that, I worked 15 years just with nonprofits.
Uh-huh.
So I've been with nonprofits for the last 30 years, and I'd say the last 15 with technology. So, yeah, it has been a career.
So looking back, if someone had told you things would be this way and you'd have a Packard Foundation, you'd be a visiting scholar, if I'm correct on my terminology, and, you know, have the ability to blog 3 times a week, you'd have a book coming out, and that you'd be connected with all of these influencers in various aspects of social media, would you be surprised?
Yes. but yes, I would, because it wasn't something that I did intentionally. It's not something
mm-hmm.
that, this is my goal and I'm going to try to achieve this. I just follow my passion.
Mm-hmm.
Go where it leads me.
And so when the journey started, you know, down the path, we talked about early adoption, but maybe folks don't know as much about kind of what are you doing, you know, what were you doing at that moment? You know, what were you employed to do, and kind of, you know, were you able to leave a position to be able to take, you know, kind of how did that transform? Was it something that was gradual, or was it more of like a hard stop, move on to the next thing?
Okay, I'll try to give you the brief.
I know these things can be long.
So what you're asking me, what was my career path?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I graduated from music school with a degree in classical flute, thinking that I'm going to sit first chair in the Boston Symphony, which was totally unrealistic because if you show up for an audition, there's 500 other people who show up for it as well, and half of them can play better than you. And the job doesn't necessarily turn over that much, and there's not that many orchestras. So I decided if I couldn't play in the Boston Symphony, that maybe I could manage it. And so I started, so I went around asking orchestra managers, can I be an orchestra manager? What do I need to learn how to do? And they said, you need to learn how to type, honey. This was like in the 70s. And so I ignored the honey part, and then I used my metronome. You know what a metronome is?
Yes, of course.
Okay. And I practiced, and I learned how to type like I learned how to play the piano. And I started with adagio, and I went up to scherzo, so I could type 120 words per minute accurately, which is a really useful skill to have to get a job with a nonprofit.
Yeah.
And so I worked in the development office, and I did every single job there was in the development office, so prospect research. And I learned the development end. And then after a year and a half, I thought I should manage the Boston Symphony. Who was I? I was just an arrogant 20-year-old. You know. So I actually made an appointment with the general manager asking them, I want to get into management. And so they told me that I should manage a small nonprofit locally, that would be a great experience. So I managed the Pro Arte Chamber Orchestra. I was, and I brought it from like me being the only employee up to, you know, having a professional level orchestra, I mean, small orchestra, with staff and doing concerts, et cetera. And then from there, I decided I was a project junkie. So I started work. This was in the 80s. So I started working independently as a consultant, but I would get technical assistance grants from the local arts council in Massachusetts. And they were really small grants, and they would hire me, and I would coach them on their fundraising, marketing, setting up systems. I learned a lot from managing a small organization. I learned about accounting. I learned about strategic planning, managing a board, fundraising and marketing. So I had all these this knowledge that I could help other nonprofits. So I did so many of these that I started to get a really good sense of an overview of small arts organizations, and I was hired as a consultant by the National Endowment for the Arts to do grant evaluations. And that was really cool because I got flown all over the country, and I would spend a day on site interviewing and writing an analysis of the organization's capacity to implement the grant. And then, so I did a lot of, you know, independent projects, and then the next really cool one was when I discovered technology, and this was at the New York Foundation for the Arts because they had gotten this grant to run this network, online network called ArtsWire, and this was in the 90s. And
I remember ArtsWire.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I do, because I was really interested in the NEA at one point, but anyway, go ahead.
So that's funny. So I was like, I have to have this job. and I was like, but I knew nothing about modems or technology. I hadn't even been on the internet. I mean, I knew nothing. So I convinced them that I could learn it and turn around and teach. And so for 10 years, I worked with New York Foundation for the Arts on their arts and technology projects. And basically it was wonderful because they would get a five-year grant. And so it was the first year you kind of figure it out. The second year you learn from your first pilots. And the third year you have it down and you do it really well for 3 years. And then the funding runs out and you get the next grant and repeat the cycle. So I did that with the online network, you know, so online facilitation. And then that moved into how to create web pages and use email and internet tools. And then the next project was around building online technology strategic plan. So how do you integrate technology into all the arts organization? And I also served as their circuit rider running around New York State, crawling under the desk and plugging in the local area network cords, or else, we need a database. Okay, let me sit down and build one for you in Access. Or how do you use PowerPoint? Oh, okay, here's a lesson. So, and then
not a techie.
No, because what I would do is I would make friends with all my technical friends who knew a lot more than me, and when I needed, then I would spend time with them saying, can you show me how to do this?
Oh,
I don't know. And then they would, and then I would struggle with understanding it, and then I could explain it to someone else, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I was always like finding people who knew more than me and then turning around and explaining it to someone else.
Right.
Yeah, so that's, and then I worked more broadly with nonprofits, always as a consultant, projects with NTAN and et cetera. And I, at the time that I started doing the social media stuff, I was still doing, you know, my consultant work. And that time I was doing things like evaluation. I was evaluating technology projects and strategic planning and assessment and research papers.
That's amazing. I mean, it sounds like you really took the bull by the horns in terms of your career initially, and that really helped propel you at such a young age to be able to have these amazing experiences to lend as you matured.
Yeah, I've discovered early on I was not a cubicle person, and I was comfortable with not having a regular income.
Yeah, two key things when it comes to possibly almost, well, not every, but a lot of nonprofit work, right? Or at least consultancy in general. But that's you know, interesting because I never, you know, you never really get the background on folks, and it's interesting that you ended up on the West Coast as well. So we're lucky to have you here.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you have to, you know, and also you learn a lot, too, about being a consultant. There's a whole college of consultants that you can courses that you can take, you know, how to manage clients, how to manage yourself. I'm a big independent, my style of working is I'm self-directed.
Mm-hmm. You pretty much have to be, I think, if you're a consultant.
Yeah, so it fits for me.
Yeah.
And I'd like, and now being a parent, it's also really great because I have the flexibility.
To be able to be there for recitals or judo or whatever it is that the kids are working on. So, you know, we have a listener question as we've been listening, and maybe I've taken too long to get to it. But earlier on you mentioned sentiment, you know, and there's this whole piece about listening and then sentiment analysis. And for folks that may not know, sentiment analysis would be, you know, people's attitudes and opinions about a particular nonprofit or an area such as healthcare, let's say. And Rich Reeder wrote in and said basically, you know, how do you make that transition, and I'm paraphrasing what he wrote in. Let me read what he said. He said, how do you move from listening to understanding sentiment?
That's really good. That's a great
Rich
question.
Is a good guy.
I know Rich. I know him really well.
How can we not all know Rich, right?
Yeah, from that Squared and Facebook.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think you get it from doing pattern analysis, and I know it, you know, in the PR world and the communications world, it's no different than they have long discussions about what words, how would you classify this? Is this a neutral mention? Is it a positive mention? Is it a negative mention? What words, if people use these particular words about us, is that negative or positive? From a tactical point, I know with those people that are listening, you know, you could classify it into three sections. They are saying something nice about us, so we're going to leave a comment and do relationship building. They're saying there's a customer complaint about us, and then you look at it, is this complaint something we can fix? You know, is it a way for us to do better in our program, or is this a perception that we need to address in our messaging or just in our customer relations? And then the third section is kind of, oh, is this an influencer saying really nasty things about us and we need to kick into high gear before we have a PR crisis of another kind?
Mm-hmm.
So I think sort of the next frontier of the sentiment analysis is to be able to take that and overlay it with a social network analysis within your networks.
Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, this is happening now in a topical way. Like if you look at tools like Morningside Analytics, which can produce these really cool maps of, like, the blogosphere. Like, here's the progressive blogosphere on this issue, and here's the conservative blogosphere on this issue, and here's who's connected to whom. Like, who comments or who's linked to.
Right.
Then you can start to see clusters and neighborhoods of types of blogs that you might want to insert your organization's conversation into.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's kind of a tactical piece in a sense because, right, you're using a particular tool. Is that really, do you think that represents a full picture of sentiment analysis? Because there's also that piece about, you know, the debate over sentiment analysis and whether, you know, because it's so, you know, it's really considered emerging and new, and, you know, how far is a not from, you know, the word not or a word that can be construed as negative. I mean, how much weight, I guess, we should back up and say, you know, how much weight you put behind sentiment analysis and who you think is really good at it in terms of tools, companies?
Oh, Katie Payne is the expert, and she has that book, The Tools of PR Measurement. I purchased that, and I would go read her blog, and I would follow her on Twitter, Katie Payne. She's the queen.
Yep, we've had her on the show.
Great. So that's the expert.
Cool. Yeah, and she's very, you know, I mean, she, if necessary, will go and still continue to talk to people, poll people, almost, in the way that we have for a long time. It may be the only reliable way, but certainly tools are getting, you know, from what, when we chatted a few weeks back, you know, tools have gotten a lot more sophisticated. But I think, like you said, looking for, you know, the sort of sentiment within groups. One of the other things I wonder about, too, is how important it is to really understand how to, so one of the things that I get feedback on is how do we as an organization, nonprofit organization, for-profit organization, whomever it is, there seems to be this sort of disconnect about either groups or forums. How do we interact authentically with them? And I know that's, you know, there's probably no one simple answer, but I think that's one area that you've had some experience with, if I'm not mistaken, and I'd love to get just a few quick thoughts on that.
When you say groups, you mean listservs versus forums?
Yeah, exactly. So Google groups or Yahoo groups, so those types of listservs, or, you know, they could be related to a school or something else, but those are generally the groups I'm talking about, the searchable ones.
Yeah, I think you, if you're trying to set up a place for a group of people to talk to one another online, I think you have to go with where the group is comfortable. And sometimes it might be a listserv. It sometimes might be a conference call. It's like, you know, it could be a face-to-face meeting, or it could be a Facebook group, or it could be, you know, if it's something that has to be done privately, it could be, an, you know, Huddle or any one of the online collaboration tools. But you have to, first of all, know what your group's individual comfort level and skill level is with the tools, and you also have to understand what your group's orientation is, what they want to do together, and then you can start matching it with specific features and then specific tools. Too often we just pick a tool.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
work.
And I mean, it can be because, you know, I mean, in the nonprofit world, it can be because you've gotten
it's
a really lucrative grant, you know, and so you're thinking, oh, well, this makes perfect sense, and then folks won't interact with it. So, you know, I think to your point, you know, you got to make sure that there is some comfort level, or it may not even be worth the time to set it up quite at that moment.
Yeah, you know, we have these lately I've been having sort of these discussions almost, oh, let's set up a little work spot online before the meeting. And I'm like, well, okay, who has the time to facilitate this and to set it up and make sure it works? And then we all kind of go silent and say, well, do we really need this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's also thinking about your capacity to manage it as well and what's the value added that it's bringing. Like, why
right.
are you doing this?
So, you know, one of your favorite tools, name one for collaboration that you really like for your comfort level.
Well, one of the things that I'm finding that I have to do in so many instances is that I'm collaborating with many different people across many different platforms. So I feel like my favorite tool is the ability to quickly learn a new tool. That's my most important tool set. And not to get too comfortable with one particular tool, because then I find myself being resistant to wanting to learn something.
I see.
So, but one tool that I've just been playing with recently that I sort of like, and it's been around for a while, and in fact co-wrote the book on it, was Backpacket, which is from 37 Signals.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little, you know, file sharing slash wiki collaboration spot. And
mm-hmm.
it's really, for us, it was really good because we were still working with in Word because
mm-hmm.
of formatting issues. So it was really a great place for us to put up documents and put annotations on the documents and pass, and it had a calendar in it so we could also put our deadlines. And it had this really easy little whiteboard feature so you could
mm-hmm.
stick. We could have, when we had our meetings, we would take notes on that. So
mm-hmm.
it was perfect for what we needed it for.
Very cool. So that's, is that Backpack or Backpacket?
It's called Backpacket, and it's the
from
lighter version
signals.
Of Basecamp.
Right.
Basecamp is a sort of heavier weight file sharing project management tool.
Yeah, and that one, that's great for rollback features. If you roll something out and you don't like it, you can take it away really quickly using Basecamp. But, yeah, for the lighter stuff, it sounds like, I mean, I've had really good experiences using Basecamp, so I will definitely check out Backpacket as well.
It's really designed for really small, you know, short-term projects.
Got it. Cool. Well, you have given us so much to think about today. I really appreciate you coming on the program. We could go on and on. And, you know, I think that it's really invaluable anytime you're able to chat with us out here in the regular world that kind of straddle different worlds. But I really, really appreciate you taking the time, Beth.
Great. Thank you so much for inviting me. This was fun.
You're very welcome, and I'll let you get on with your day. Thank you so much. And I want to thank everyone who's tuned in to the A-List today with me, Jennifer Lindsay, and, of course, Beth Cantor. We hope you enjoyed the program. If so, we'd love it if you'd be so kind as to friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio. Be sure to tune in Thursday of next week, November 5th, when my guest will be Anne Glenn. She's the senior web producer of social media at Sony Pictures Imageworks Interactive. That's a mouthful. 12 noon Pacific next week. I want to hear from you, so please start tweeting in or Facebooking in your questions to my Twitter handle or Facebook page now. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show and archives at jenniferlindsay.com. Have a great weekend and happy Halloween, everyone.